We're really at that point where we have to start thinking more about what we're going to do with the data when you get it. So first, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements. The first one is, anyone lose some glasses? I'll have them. And, you know, they're readers. Then the cruise, there's still room tomorrow for the cruise on the harbor. And you can register at the Notto table. And we've got a lot of people going, and it's a great opportunity to network. The reception. Now, when the sessions are done, and for those of you who stay for the duration, we will treat you to a reception on the third floor. It's outside, and it is a cash bar. And don't forget we are on Twitter and Facebook. Hashtag Notto, hashtag health data at Notto News. And some of the updates and some of the links to the slides and other things can be found there. So we're trying to enter the age of social media. So with that, I will turn it over to this wonderful panel.
Good afternoon, and thank you for sticking with us. I'm Michael Lundberg, and I have the pleasure today of introducing this panel and giving a little background on best practices and data release. So in the Broadway musical, Hello, Dolly, many of you know about Dolly Levi. She was a precocious, fun-loving woman that was married to Horace, who loved to spend money, especially his. So Horace actually didn't always go along with that so much, but at one point, Dolly sort of took him to task and said that, look, money is like manure, pardon my expressions. It doesn't do any good unless it's spread around, helping small things to grow. Well, so what's the point? Data's kind of like that too, in that it's not manure, but it's no good unless we spread it around. And this is all about best practices and data release. So it isn't any value if it's not used by your organization in a way that's helpful, your peer organizations or your other state or collaborative organizations or related organizations or if your licensees, if you license the data or if you have custom reports or others. But there's a lot of challenges to that. There's all different types of reports today and they're growing. It could be a paper report, it could be a web report, it could be an Excel file, it could be a database, it could be an online query or an HTML file. All of these different things have different challenges about the control of the data where you go there. So when you're releasing data, how will you protect any personal health information or other sensitive information that you have? How do you take into account state and federal laws, whether it's the OCR regs or HIPAA regs or other things? Today's panelists are going to cover the key issues, strategies, successes, and the lessons learned that they found in their various areas of practice. So without further ado, we're going to start off, and our first panelists, we're going to be talking with Policies and Processes for Release by Srinivas Sidhara from Maryland.
Is that working? Oh, great. Well, thank you so much. This is a pretty broad area, let's say, and so 7 to 10 minutes is probably not adequate, certainly, and the depth of the issues related to sort of protection of privacy and data release are quite broad. So, bear that in mind. As Michael mentioned, there's a variety of ways one might release data these days. Today, I'm really going to be focusing more on sort of the actual, sort of the traditional, if you will, data release, if you're sending data to someone, though I think many of these concepts really apply to, you know, web publications or, you know, online portals and so forth as well. The other thing is that though many of our APCDs, including our own, have Medicaid data, Medicare data, and other such, there's some other considerations related to those data sets, and so I'm really sort of sticking to the privately insured issues, but again, I think the issues are not really very different in how you would go about these. So just a quick overview of what I'm hoping to cover today. One, we should figure out why are we releasing data in the first place and to whom, basically, and so who are appropriate users. Second is, what data should we release? And finally, if you've decided what and to whom, and then how do you go about accomplishing it? So why release data? First of all, as all of you know, there's this extraordinary explosion in demand for data. But in these scenarios, you know, there's a lot of people dreaming big dreams, but we have to find a way to balance those exciting opportunities with the risks of inadvertently revealing identity or posing risk to some. And so I think there is a real danger in sort of this notion of unfettered access to data, and we have to figure out how do we present it, whether it's in a data release or elsewhere, so that we provide the adequate context and educate folks on the uses of data. And that sort of precedes by the time you actually get to release it. So a basic question then that you have is, what are the appropriate uses of this data? And they could be a variety of purposes. Many of us started with either academic research or perhaps the notion of decision support. A lot of us here are have rate review grants now to SSIO, so maybe we're supporting insurance administrations or, in our case, a hospital waiver program. You know, there's a lot of different uses one might have, but there are also sort of our quality and price transparency metrics. And one interesting area I think that we've started to get some interest is sort of companies that have private development programs that want to build tools that they want to sell on. And so I think this poses a lot of sort of a different arena of potential interest that I think should be considered. I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong to this, but probably more in how you secure the data in that process. So presuming you have figured that out, a challenge in itself. Who are the appropriate users? And so this, and users I take here as sort of a broad swath. So, you know, you have your consumer reporting kind of activities, but, you know, providers might be interested. Some of the programs here are qualified entity programs, so you might be trying to get data out to providers. Insurance carriers may have interest in doing market analyses or otherwise, academic research certainly, and again, the notion of private companies. And so one thing that I think we should think about in that is, regardless of who is applying for this data and what they intend to use it for, I think it's important to establish some minimum qualifications for a user. So these could be from experience with big data, experience with protecting confidential information, their infrastructure that they have to maintain it, and policies and rules. I'll mention some of these a little bit later. So what data should we be releasing? And I think before you do that, you probably should be first sitting down and understanding who are your stakeholders and what are their concerns. The next item is, of course, figuring out how you're going to protect that data. I'm not really going to delve into this topic today because I think you have two more presentations coming that'll do a better job of diving a little deeper on that issue. And then one other way that you can sort of streamline how you review it eventually, but also limit the exposure, is setting different levels of privacy for data that you might release, so you have some standard data to get out to folks. So some of the stakeholders' concerns that you should at least consider. With consumers, there's the general issue of release of information and protection of their privacy. This isn't I know there's been some conversations about how they would use data, but this is more consideration of your release of data and the risks involved. As Michael mentioned, there are various laws that apply to it, HIPAA and CR, as you mentioned, and what does PHI mean and all of those things. And so I think that there are some depth to that conversation that needs to occur. With payers, some of the feedback we've heard, of course, is that they're often concerned about their negotiated rates being revealed, or potential for anti-competitive activities, and sort of identification of them as the payer. And so we have usually taken the route that we try not to reveal it, and we haven't really for any real purpose. There hasn't been a good use case so far for that release. And then finally, you have providers, state partners, other users of data. And I think one of the big challenges, even before you get to the point of release, is packaging things in useful ways. And sometimes it's not really the claim level file that most folks can really use. It might be summary level files at a patient or provider level, or just a geographic summary would do for many. And so I think that's a worthwhile discussion to have. So this is a really big table, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to give you sort of some notions of the levels of privacy one might set for data. This follows along with really what CMS does in defining what they call research identifiable files, limited data sets, and public use files, which I imagine many of you are familiar with. And this, I've added a few extra here that we've considered that are at the bottom here that are some of the specific claims information. At the top, what you have is sort of the basic identifier type information that you normally consider. So for example, a good one to think about is zip code, which you would include perhaps in a research identifiable file. But as you move to a limited data set or a public use file, usually HIPAA requires that if the base population is less than 20,000 for a zip code, you're not supposed to release it with a fully five-digit identifier. You would mask it to a three-digit, as just an example. And so I think there are considerations in that way that you should review and what is the need. And I'd say in this sort of gradation of these, most folks don't really need the research identifiable files, and even limited data sets sometimes aren't really all that needed. I think Kevin was talking about it earlier, which is we need to really understand what is the use and what is the analysis being conducted, and do you really need all of this? Because a common request we get is just, oh yeah, just give me the whole file. I mean, I'll work with it. And the truth is, they don't know the first thing about claims analysis usually. But then, you know, it's sort of, you know, beyond that, even those who know, they're, you know, for ease of not taking the time to figure out what they want, you ask for everything. And I think as a responsible custodian of data, you should be also figuring out, do you really need the whole file? Even if you are well equipped and well qualified, you don't need the whole data set unless it's truly essential to your analysis. And so then, given that you've done all of that, you've figured out who you're sending the data to, what they can do with it, what are the types of data products you have, you still need to put in place a system of how you would systematically and transparently release the data. So the first thing is that transparency is essential in all of this, whether it's to your stakeholders, some people who are submitting data, to consumers, to other policymakers. I think that's absolutely essential. And you can do this in a variety of ways in terms of the composition of your review committee. You know, we've considered in a long while ago, it used to be a lot of reviews occurred sort of by staff, and then it would maybe go to an IRB if it was appropriate. But I think there's interest now, especially if you're doing more identifiable or sensitive data, to have some sort of multi-stakeholder group. This is not a group that is equivalent to a privacy board or IRB, but to have enough input and transparency on the process so that people are aware and comfortable with your release process. And so, as I've mentioned, the stakeholder engagement is key in that, and making sure people understand why you're releasing it and how. One of the things that I think some states have started doing, and we are planning to start doing as well, is putting those applications during the time of review on your website or somewhere for allow for public comment. And this is a good way to protect yourself as well, because I think, you know, we don't think about it often, but we're really taking on a lot of liabilities when we do these and sort of how we release the data. So one of the essential things, as I alluded to earlier, is ensuring data security. We've taken on a similar process to what CMS essentially does and ask for detailed data management plans from potential recipients of data. And we review everything from their policies and practices for data security to user managements to where the data is going to be and how we get notified and you know, having specific requirements for the data transfer, data destruction, and you know, date that we follow up on and all of that. And these are all, of course, you know, codified into our DUA template. And one of the challenges is, of course, then you put it into a document, but then it goes into some drawer or some unknown file in your server, but you actually have to follow up on it and make sure they, you know, 2 years later they deleted the data or attested to it or did something, you know. So I think a lot of this is, you know, doing your due diligence and being vigilant to maintain it over time. So then the other important thing, I think, as an issue that has come up is when and how do you engage an IRB? And I think in the past, it used to be always an IRB was this one group that reviewed everything. But the reality is a lot of the data that we deal with, if you think of it as secondary data analysis, really, when you're talking about claims data, and I guess, again, I should mention that this is all in the context of claims data, there are, many of us are also thinking about linking to clinical data and data in which it might be used for TPO and all of that. And that's a whole nother ball of wax, and then you would definitely want an IRB. But that aside here, privacy boards are much easier to form, and they have less restrictions in how you construct them. IRBs have a lot more challenges to maintain, and especially if you don't have enough frequency of requests and reviews, IRBs aren't as effective. And so I think privacy boards is something to consider as an alternative, and then you can figure out who are the appropriate people in there. And also, I think whether it was the multi-stakeholder group or your staff, I think you can eliminate a lot of troubles by doing a lot of review ahead of time. This doesn't have to be the official sign-off, but you know, making sure that the research question aligns with the data and how it's used and so forth, you can head off a lot of troubles coming up. And so I'll just mention some practical considerations to close. There are many more things to think about, but you know, there are being consistent in how you do forms and the application process. Who receives it in your organization, does an initial screen, sends it off? Who are all the team members that touch it and review it? Because you need people with different skill sets to do those. If you have fees, and what do you have fees for the review, for the release? Is it licensing? Is it a one-time fee? Is it a per year? All of that. And then the other thing is, you know, we all know, and I think Michael mentioned, is sort of we need the, you know, data to be used to make the data better and for us to understand it better. But part of that, in order to be useful to folks, is providing the technical support and documentation to make that useful and usable. So that's a very brief overview, and I don't know if I've run over my time anyhow, but certainly, you know, there are many other experts in this area here today, so I'm sure there are others who might offer some additional insights, but I'm happy to answer questions at the end if needed. My contact information, it's in our packets as well if you need it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Charles, would you like to talk to us about the identification?
Switch here and see. Oh, there we go. All right. So here we got a title slide, which a little sandwiched in there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss the identification. First, what I'm going to do is give a little bit of oversight about what we included in our what we call DIADS, which is the de-identified APCD data set. In Utah, and then I'm going to discuss more about how. So I could give probably an entire 10-minute presentation on the what's in the DIADS, so I'm going to keep this brief. But essentially what we did is we took what we call legacy data. So we collected data from 2008 to mid-2013. Some of you, I think, are aware from previous NATO conferences that we lost a vendor in the middle of 2013. And we call that legacy data. We took our legacy data, we sort of truncated 2011 is where the quality was decent, and ran that through 2013 for the sake of de-identification. Obviously, we collect multiple files. We have a patient file, provider file, medical claims and pharmacy claims, but in the spirit of de-identification, we only have a medical and pharmacy claims file. These are I believe the medical claims file is 58 million rows, and the pharmacy claims file is 61 million. So it's about 18 gigs of data. And we made this available in July of this year. So because I think it's important to highlight the use, I guess. So it, to the point that we lost a data vendor, it was important for us to sort of show value in the data and to understand our data by opening it up and being transparent. So there was this push for us to release this data in July. This is a really important point that we like to make, and this is a policy point. The Office of Healthcare Statistics is not a covered entity under HIPAA, and so we had some leeway to do de-identification, you know, as we saw fit, if you will. We obviously use HIPAA as a guideline for proven practice, and we certainly tried to rely on some of those proven practices, but I think that it is important, you know, as you guys go out and consider what, you know, what you want to do in terms of de-identification. You know, what we did is maybe an example where HIPAA wasn't necessarily an obstacle as much as it was a structure. So, and I think that this also, because of that, you know, I think of de-identification, you can kind of do it in two different ways, maybe three or four, but I think of it in two ways. So you can do sort of statistical masking de-identification, which I know there are vendors here and there's going to be a group tomorrow, the day after, that's going to discuss that a little bit more. The other way to do it is sort of policy-based, and that is what we did. So I put de-identification in quotes here because, you know, we call it the de-identified APCD data set, or DIADS, but it's really a misnomer. It just kind of stuck, and so we've gone forward with it. But the reality is that it's not a de-identified data set. It is a limited data set. So for something to be de-identified under HIPAA, it could be distributed openly. And that's not the case here. There's more risk. I actually have no idea where the term limited comes from, but I assume it has to do with there's this limited risk that you're taking on. So there's a risk of re-identification still in this data. And we accept that and fall back on policy. That policy again is guided by Safe Harbor under HIPAA, as well as our facilities data release. So we collect facilities data within the Office of Healthcare Statistics as well, and we used that limited data set or public use file as sort of a guideline as to how to do these things, and I'll explain a little bit more. So the comparison of Safe Harbor to what we did is a good point. So the facilities data also does these things that we've done for the APCD data. And when I say these things, I mean we've departed from Safe Harbor in these significant ways, one of which is age categories. So under Safe Harbor, you list dates by year. So you would give a birth date and it would say 1984. And I guess that's kind of a category because if you receive service this year and you have a birth date that's 1984, you could be 29 or 30, right? But it's not the same in terms of how we bend our groups. So we created age categories that are in some ways more conservative and in some ways less conservative. So at the beginning of life, we have a 1 to 28 day category, and then we have a 29 to 365 day age category. And then we go to more or less 5-year bins. It gets a little weird around 18 because that's a meaningful number to us as a society. The Safe Harbor guideline actually suggests binning anything above 89 years of age, and we actually bin above 65 because we're talking about commercial data. So anybody above 6, it gets really easy to re-identify. So that's, you know, there's this give and take that we've done in all of these different things, where in some ways I would say we were more conservative and in other ways we weren't. We were a little bit more liberal with our policy. Service dates, we actually did release specific service dates, and this was due to feedback that we received. A lot of these things were due to feedback that we received from prospective users or stakeholders. They said, if you don't give us this information, it's really not useful to us. So we heard that, and we tried to give more information where we could. So there are actual service dates. Again, those would typically be binned by, or not binned, but they would just be a service year under Safe Harbor. And we have small health areas in Utah. These were developed internally. They're based on zip codes. There's a little bit of departure from that, but for the most part, they're based on zip codes. So this is kind of interesting. because when we went to release this, we said, well, we can do the three-digit zip code, as Srinivas was mentioning, and people said, well, that's not really useful. In Utah, I think there's 5 or 7, one or the other, three-digit zip codes, and they're really big areas. It's geographically, and they're not all that similar. So we decided instead to use the small health areas, which we've done in the past. They're developed based on some experience within the Department of Health, and they're developed to be similar in terms of population size. So again, the interesting thing here is that the three-digit zip codes, it really prescribes the number 20,000 for a population. So that's the concern of Safe Harbor, is that you have 20,000 people. Our small health areas are geographically smaller. There's about 60 of them. So you're more specific than a three-digit zip, but at the same time, they are somewhat more conservative than what Safe Harbor prescribes, because they tend to be about 35,000 to 50,000 in terms of population. So we're still, I guess we're giving people more information, but at the same time, we're still being conservative in terms of what the guideline is. So, and if you're interested in the Utah Health Small Areas, there's more information on our website. You can kind of Google Utah Small Health Areas, and it'll give you a whole bunch of zip codes and things. So this is kind of our release process. So this, Srinivas hit on all of these things already, but I'll just kind of re-highlight them. So under Cycle 3, we have a Cycle 3 and Cycle 4 grants. We actually developed an online application. So we have that now, so people can go on and make requests for the data. They have to sign a data use agreement. We have different tiers of data use agreements based on internal use within the state, as well as external use. And the data use agreement specifically, because we're talking about limited data, we had to be very careful to make sure that it's clear in there that it's prohibited to try and to attempt to re-identify this data. It's actually against state law as well. And it's prohibited. Redistribution of the data is also prohibited. So those are really important pieces for us. And then also, again, to Srinivas's points, that we have an approval process. It goes, the applications are received, they're reviewed. Internally, the staff looks at them and we say, oh, does this look like anything really crazy? And from there, they go out to a subcommittee of our health data committee, which is has the legal authority to kind of tell how this data is used. And so this subcommittee reviews the applications and approves them, essentially. So that's kind of our process. And if you guys have questions, I'm more than happy to talk about them. I'm actually interested to know a little bit more about how generalizable it is. I'm interested in seeing how that goes. But the one last quick plug here is that the data is available. You can, for what is the word, the language that we use? It's approved, it's, what is it, qualified researchers with approved uses, we say it's publicly available, and then we say, but you have to be qualified, so.
Very good.
Thank you.
Alicia, would you like to talk to us about suppression?
Sure, I've got mine on here. Yes, so I am with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare. We are a nonprofit organization, and we administer Colorado's All Payer Claims Database. You heard my colleague Jonathan Matthew talk a little bit this morning. We help Coloradans drive, deliver, and buy value in healthcare. So I put together some slides. I'm going to first talk about suppression in our public reporting, and then I'll talk a little bit about suppression in our non-public reporting. So we provide data, again, our legislative mandate requires that we do have a lot of our data publicly reported on our website. We are also we also provide non-public releases of data. So similar to what you've heard, we have a policies and procedures. We do have a data review and release committee that approves all release of data, limited and fully identifiable data. So our Data Review and Release Committee did create a process such that de-identified data releases can occur without their individual approval of each one. So again, I'll talk a little bit about that, but for our public reporting on our website, which is cohealthdata.org or comedprice.org, they both drive you to the same place, we actually chose, and I've been with Civic a little under a year, so a lot of these decisions were made prior to my joining, but we do use CMS's standard of suppressing all data points with fewer than 11 events. And, you know, since I joined, one of our major accomplishments over the last year is that we have brought Medicare fee-for-service claims into our database in the past year. We've done this under the state agency process. So one thing about selecting, using CMS's standard is that if you bring in their data, then you're already set up. You don't have to change your standard. So I would say, you know, that's a major lesson learned. You know, I have a screenshot here. One example, we ran into many of our data, publicly reported data at the population level, is county-based utilization metrics. A lot of those we do not run into a small sample size, but when we added readmission measures late last year, we started to run into those. So if you think about the proportionate readmission measure, so readmissions as a percentage of all discharges, we in some of our smaller counties, we definitely ran into the need to suppress. We also show a data completeness score. And I'll move on to, this is kind of an example of suppression in action. I picked two of our smaller counties. Actually, these are all three small counties. So you'll see we use the number sign, the pound sign, to indicate the data was suppressed. So when you look up at the overall on that top line, and I apologize, this is kind of small, you know, we do have the overall rate, but when we break that down by service line, we ran into small numbers, which caused us to need to suppress. The completeness score that you see up there, that it is indicated by a C1, C2, C3, or C4, it is simply a quartile that represents the proportion of all residents for that geographic location that are represented in the All Payer Claims database. And we caution the user, the lower that completeness score, so if it's less than 25%, you use caution when interpreting these results. And again, as I mentioned, several of our readmission measures, we run into this, some of our other, you can kind of see here, we have a lot of utilization metrics. So just this past summer, at the end of July, we also added, part of our legislative mandate was to provide price and quality for consumers. So this was when we first rolled out for four events, facility-specific prices. So we again also went with the CMS standard of 11 events. So we started out by reporting prices for vaginal and cesarean births separately, hip replacements and knee replacements. And we it looks a little different. Again, that part of the website is geared toward consumers. So we show it as data not available. And we link to a total volume spreadsheet, which I'm going to show you. It is not that consumer friendly right now, with a data completeness score. So I will tell you, we originally were not planning to include this information. When we tested, I'll go ahead and kind of show you. So we did some information with consumers, and we heard that, you know, consumers often equate high volume with quality. Our database currently only includes our fully insured commercial data. We do not have self-funded, and in our state, that is just over 50%. So we did not want to show volume, knowing our data, the volume does not represent 100% of the commercial volume, so we had made that decision. However, during our preview period with our hospitals, they specifically asked for this information to be included. So right now it is included as kind of a link. We are going to be testing this with consumer focus groups early next year to kind of figure out if we can come up with a way to show this in a meaningful way for consumers, you know, where it would show up all right here. So currently, if you, and this is a search for, it's a suburb of Denver, we're looking for prices on cesarean births on private or commercial insurance. And you'll see the estimated price that is a median price. And you'll see two asterisks, and it shows data not available. And then down by the data not available, this is where we did add, at the request and input from our hospitals, you know, this facility may perform this service, but the price data is not currently available. And if you click, it takes you, this is the one I said, not that great right now, and of course, for a slide, we do show their total volume, because that was, the hospitals really said, gosh, the data in the APCD, you know, one hospital had, you know, 38 cesarean births. We have over 1,000. So that was a particular hospital that has a very high proportion of self-funded patients. You know, and they wanted that information out there that we do. We did choose not to put actual numbers. We put it in a range of 50. There was some concern that they didn't want a number here that was different than the number they publicly reported. So we went with that. As well as a completeness score. So another issue I was kind of asked to touch on was concerns about releasing negotiated rates. And you know, Srinivas, you mentioned that as well. So for our median price data, we actually kind of got around that by showing the median price for the total event. So we have added the facility paid or allowed amount plus professional, median professional paid amount, plus the median of any other or ancillary paid amounts. That we are displaying one single price. It kind of avoids the negotiated rate issues with facilities, and I will say when we went through our hospital preview period, initially the hospitals did not like that. They said, well, we want that out there, but then they wanted the facility portion. When they really started validating the data, you know, they got into, oh, this is pretty close, if not, you know, a negotiated rate. So then they really backed into, all right, we like how it is now. And prior to that experience, we had actually done some consumer focus groups where we did present it both ways, kind of a pie chart, here's the proportion. Consumers did not like that. They said, we want one price. We know we receive multiple bills when we're in the hospital for a procedure, but we hate that, it's confusing. We want one price. So that is what we are currently displaying, and again, it was preferred by consumers. And you know, after walking through the process of data validation, our hospital community also preferred that, as well as, you know, we previewed this with the payers, and they were comfortable with that as well. So I think that's my last slide. I will touch on our non-public release. So we also continue that using the CMS standard of suppressing any, if there are fewer than 11 events. When we are providing custom reports, we do the same. The data is suppressed if there are fewer than 11 events in any cell, essentially. When we have requests that come to us for limited data sets or fully identifiable data sets, you know, our data review and release committee, along with our staff and my colleague Jonathan, does lead kind of that process. We review to look at, you know, the small cell sizes, and in some cases that will be suppressed. So we've had a few examples of data requests where they were looking for infectious diseases in very rural counties. And, you know, we were looking at, you know, when you have three cases of, name your infectious disease, Ebola these days, you know, that's we did not release that. Again, we also look at the risk for re-identification. And finally, as you heard also, we do have in our data use agreement, any time that a recipient of data plans to release the data, they also must abide by the CMS suppression rules, and we, Civic, have to be able to review anything before they publicly release or report data. So,
excellent.
Call.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we have a few moments for questions. Do we need microphones, Denise, or is it just fine for me to stand up?
We can just shut them out.
All right.
So in terms of data release, we've had some interesting requests for our data from marketing entities and for entities that want to combine our data with, you know, like those fitness devices, you know, and also social media. And I just wondered whether those kinds of requests are coming to you guys, and what do you do with those?
So we, I think we had one request that came sort of like that, but then we had a, a long conversation with them, and it turned out that they really weren't ready to use this data. It wasn't going to be truly meaningful to them. But I think this is, we're feeling this out. I don't think there's a final answer to this in any way. I think the general feeling with some of our staff or otherwise is that we don't want to limit the availability to sort of those sorts of uses, but we'll fall back on sort of protection of privacy and the real need for it and so forth. But at least for us, we haven't had a specific release of that type.
And a follow-up for Utah, where you're not, I think most of the entities that collect, most of our APCD entities are not covered entities under HIPAA, but have chosen to, sort of follow the HIPAA guidelines. But in our discussions, of course, that's not a proper use of data. To release to a marketing entity is not a proper use. So we wouldn't do that, nor would our membership want us to do that. In fact, they would probably, my son's generation might be okay with it. I was just wondering, there may be something where you don't want to squash, this is the new thing, right? But on the other hand, is it right? I mean, what would the people think about it?
I think that's probably a good question for lots of people. So what's right or wrong? But there are so many technologies and sort of that drive back, and especially if people start linking, say, health information exchange information or EHR information with APCD data, and people are developing apps that will help them for their care and so forth. But tough to know.
And in Utah, it's a bridge that we just haven't crossed. We haven't gotten there yet. We, like I said, it was July when we released.
Yeah. Okay, well, when you get back
thanks for jinxing us. we've only released the data about, I think we've had 15 requests approximately. So, and they're mostly university and payers, submitters. So.
And we have had some similar ones. One of the things that is part of our data release process, all release requests must, so it is intended that we will release data to entities, organizations who are doing research or quality improvement to improve the triple aim for Coloradans. So they have to really demonstrate that any use of this data will result in improving the triple aim for Coloradans. So many times those types of requests, they really can't come up with a good justification for that, so they wouldn't even make it to our data review and release committee. Then when they do, we again then would have long discussions with our DRRC data review and release committee about the appropriateness of those.
We're sort of dancing around this idea of appropriate use, which shows up, I know, in Virginia legislation. You spoke about appropriate use. When the data review committees meet, do they have any way of quantifying what appropriate use is, or is it the kind of thing you know it when you see it?
Seems that way at present. I think there are. I think it's probably easier to say there are certain things that are not appropriate uses that we can qualify. But. It's tough, I think, and especially as things are evolving now, that we haven't thought of all the ways we might use this data, and many people aren't even aware, and they're coming to understand that such data is even available, and so we'll probably face many of these questions of, is this appropriate or not, and we'll have to sort of evolve with it.
And I think one of the roles we as APCD administrators are finding ourselves in more often than not are that of consultants.
Yeah.
Helping the data requester, rethink and reshape their original, pie in the sky idea into what would be an appropriate use, that type of thing. So, we've done some of that.
In the back. So I've been on both sides of this. I'm Adam Dudley from UCSF, and I've been on both sides of this. I am a researcher. I've also, for various times in my life, played the role of the data warehouser, receiving the requests, and felt that, I don't even want to deal with it, much less say yes. So I think that balance between the benefits of getting the data out of what we might get out of it and the risks that we would all feel if we're the holder and then something happens, tends, at least in my experience, in the holder's heart, fall towards the avoid the risk thing. And I think there's evidence that we've been far too much on that side. So if you look at the history of transparency, we started first talking about public transparency in 1985 with HICPA released the possible performance. The Human Genome Project started 5 years later, and the entire human genome was mapped in 1998. In that time, we've gone from reporting about quality and outcomes of almost nothing to maybe three or four things per state, with lots of states that still report on nothing. So the evidence of what we've been able to produce, and furthermore, the people who've made progress in that are mainly large commercial organizations. I guess I shouldn't say names, but you know what I'm talking about. And that's complete opposite of what we did with the Human Genome Project and other things, where we generated a lot of information by dispersing broadly the access to the data. And now we have things like treatments for boy in the bubble that we didn't have before. So how do you get that? My question is, how do you get that conversation internally? How do you push that up? How would you tell me, fight back against that first natural, I'm going to hold it, you know, because I'm afraid. I don't know you. You seem like a nice person, but I don't know. How do you, in your organization, keep talking about that balance? Or maybe outside the organization, keep the pressure on.
Wow.
The legislature helps sometimes, I can tell you that.
Having legislation to support would certainly help, and I think part of it will change with societal sort of, cultural changes. But I think one experiment that we're trying, that Linda, who was up here before, mentioned, was that we were trying to experiment with having universities hold the data and find some uses for their research and to maybe even essentially serve as consultants to others. In our case, we're concerned most about state uses, but perhaps broadly. And so we're trying to dabble in that and see if we can get them more access to that data and see how it goes. I mean, it's really in sort of a test sort of model that we're trying out now, and we'll see. And I think, I think it's a tough time now where there is this changing, comfort with lack of privacy, if you will. But at the same time, when you have sort of, in the financial world where you've had these credit card releases and things like that, people are also seizing up. So it's sort of, it's how to navigate those countervailing sort of forces is tough. But I think, at least in our case, we agree with the general notion we need to find ways to get this data out to people who could make good use of it and be improving the health of Marylanders and perhaps beyond. But I think that at the baseline, we have to still rest on, as custodians, we have to ensure data security and sort of that the user is qualified to do it. And I think if we can do that, I think the use range should be broad and get the data to the hands of users.
Right. So I'd say that risk is kind of a funny concept, because you run this risk of identification or privacy breach on one hand, but the other risk that you run is sort of, you guys ever seen that show Hoarders? You run the risk of being that person with data. And so I kind of jokingly say the legislature will help, but in Utah we had sort of a unique experience where we had collected this data from 2008, through 2013, as I was mentioning with the legacy data, and we'd spent a fair amount of money on it. And so as we went, there was this pressure for us to actually release the data rather than keep this black box notion. So, and then I guess how you kind of take that and manage that, the risk, I think, in terms of use, I think you kind of have to go back to the stakeholders or the users, and with our privacy board, if you will, we've never really called it that, but with the data use subcommittee of the HDC. The HDC is made up of various stakeholders within the community as well. So I think that we, right now, we're sort of trusting that as these uses come in and their marketing agencies or whatever, there are people that are on the HDC that are in business. They're small business or large business representatives. They're not just carriers or whomever. So we're kind of hoping that they'll help us see the innovation as we go forward.
And I don't have a great answer, but I can definitely let you know that this is my colleagues and I and our attorney have had many, many lively discussions and debates about these exact things. And it definitely helps to have, we have some team members that are very much on the, risk, they understand we want to abide by those. And then we have some that really want to push the envelope. So it is almost a daily, discussion that occurs in our organization.
Yeah, we really haven't mentioned the attorneys enough, by the way. the attorneys are the stakeholder that's being left out.
I think you know the answer, but how does FOIA, if someone, an aggressive media person, pulls a FOIA on you, the Freedom of Information Act? Yeah. I think I know the answer in Utah. I think you're covered. Are you covered?
Jonathan, FOIA, we are not. Can you jump in?
Yeah, we're not FOIA.
I thought, yeah.
We actually had one very clever vendor come to us and say, give us your APC so we can develop analytic products based on that for sale in the marketplace. We said, one, that would be a violation of HIPAA. They came back and said, we are going to FOIA you, and we said, we are not a government entity. And then they said they were going to CORA us, and CORA is the Colorado Open Records Act. And we said, we are not a state entity either. So
the laws are right, they exempt your private data from FOIA, but not all state laws do. So I'm just kind of throwing it out there for everyone to go back and look at that.
We have a couple more questions. I saw some other hands up. Yes.
So my question is for Charles. You mentioned that you don't mask your dates in the data set, and I was wondering how did you come to that decision? And HPUF does something where they mask it to allow people to look at the admissions and do some other work, and we're kind of on the fence whether we should release our dates or not. So can you kind of tell me how you came?
Yeah, so this, I kind of hinted at it before, but it really came to an issue of usability. So we have, under Cycle 3, we work with the university and a couple of researchers, and we also did some work going out and engaging the public health, various stakeholders, so consumers and public health and researchers, and with the public health group, and the research group as well, we were essentially told a couple of times that they needed to have the service dates. There's also a data quality issue here. So the service dates, and this is kind of in the weeds, but the service dates, there are claims that were rejected, there are resubmissions, and the service dates are necessary for the user to help get at which is the accurate claim. And so it really came down to the data being usable. And in order for us, basically we felt that we were not going to release a product that was useful to people if we didn't do that. And so we've sort of rested on policy again and the DUA and those kind of things. So.
This is great. Last question.
So I'm wondering if if any of you have worked with any of your education agencies on any of this in the states. I just came working with the state of Washington for the last 4 years on what they have is a P20 system. And in the state of Washington, we've grappled already through data release and a lot of this. Obviously, it's not hospital, but it's race, ethnicity, that level. And I'm just wondering, and I know not Maryland, but I know both Colorado and Utah have very robust reporting on education and student progress. So I'm just wondering if you've done any coordination with your education agencies to see how they're doing reporting.
We have not. We have not, but it's a great idea.
Yeah, and we haven't either. I never even really considered it, to be perfectly honest.
Right.
I see a lot of overlap in what we've already gone through in education, and it might just be something of interest to consider at a state level.
Yeah.
Great question. Wow, what a panel, huh? I want to say thank you for that. Okay. Don't go away. Denise is going to introduce the next panel. All right.
Great job, you guys.
What's that?
And now we will shift gears quickly to the payers. They've been sitting so patiently in the audience and listening to the states and others talk about all payer claims databases. And so now we will hear from those that provide the data.
So you've got the lavaliers there. You've got, and the slide clicker is that remote. Yeah, it just has a...
Cheryl, I need your first.
What? You want me to move over?
That would be helpful.